Donna Timmis is my guest this week. It was so wonderful to catch up with Donna, who I knew, 25 or more years ago when we were both undergraduates in Lampeter. And Donna talks about how she followed her dream of becoming a teacher. She works particularly with disabled children and those within social services. We learn about how she was the first in her family to go to university and how her parents very much valued the importance of education. We talk about the perils involved in actually getting physically, geographically to Lampeter and how she felt very safe there, unlike when she returned to Durham after her degree. She talks about her earliest memories, which involved playing collaboratively with other children. She remembers lots of green spaces from her childhood. And she talks about her tap dancing experience and her eclectic taste in music. We find out what the first record she ever bought was, and we'll find out whether On Reflection, it's a song that I'm particularly partial to. Yes, it was Dollar Mirror Mirror. She tells us about how she once saw Bucks Fizz by accident. God, that's a dream come true for me. She talks about how she could go to the cinema for 50 pence when she was young. The train fare there and back cost rather more money than that. She talks about her experience of being hit when she went to see, and you couldn't even make this up, Rocky IV. She talks about writing fan fiction regarding Dirty Dancing and how she has kept old diaries. We find out about her obsession with Babylon 5 and Terry Pratchett and the role of spirituality in his novels. Donna tells us about the teacher who most inspired her. She tells us how she voted in the 1992 general election, why the Durham Miners' Gala is so important to her, why she finds Jeremy Corbyn to be so different to other politicians. She reflects on the miners' strike from the mid-1980s and the role of extremist groups in the Northeast. Then in the final part of the interview, Donna tells us why her memories are predominantly positive. We talk about being bullied at school, why the Northeast is quite a matriarchal environment, and why she is more of a looking back than a looking forward type of person. So what an absolute pleasure to catch up after so many years with Donna Timmis for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. It is an absolute pleasure up in Durham to meet Donna Timmis again for the first time in, well, we were saying at least 25 years.
Yeah, at least.
Yeah, and you did history.
I did history and a lot of English with it.
Yeah, and it's funny, isn't it? Because I remember you always telling me that you wanted to go into teaching.
Yes.
And I think, and it sounds to me that you've completely followed that path, that
dream. Yeah, I mean, after Lampeter, I came back to Durham. So I went and did the PGCE at Durham at the School of Ed, and then got my first job the September after that in Darlington, teaching English and Humanities. And then from then on, I've taught lots of things, to be honest, but mainly English and history. But recently I've been on supply, which has been really good because it's given me the opportunity to go into fields that I hadn't. So, for example, I did FE, I've done different levels of SEN, including profoundly disabled children at a school in Darlington, which was totally out of my comfort zone. But I enjoyed it. Not that I would do it full time, but it was good for me to do that. And then leading me to where I'm at now, working with the children in the social services system.
And would you ever have thought then, all those years ago, that you'd be doing what you're doing now? It sounds like, in a way, that you're kind of doing what you'd set out to do, but has it followed the same sort of path that you would have anticipated?
No, it hasn't. Because I thought I would just be history teacher, head of history by now, in a comfortable mainstream school. But I found quite early on that I kind of connect sometimes with some of the more vulnerable children, so even in mainstream. So, for example, if we were on a trip, I'd always be surrounded with the little vulnerable ones who didn't quite feel confident enough to go off on their own for lunch. Or there would be, it's always been that kind of child that I've connected with. So, in a way, it's probably, this is the best, well, I feel now it's the best place for me in work wise. I feel really happy doing what I'm doing. It's hard work.
Yeah.
But in a completely different way.
But where are you from originally, Donna?
I'm from Newton Aycliffe, where I live now. Yeah. We moved back home. So after Lampeter, I came to Durham, but I lived at home. I got married, and I lived in Shildon, which is a town nearby, which is where my husband's from. And we lived there because the houses were cheaper. But when I had my children and I wanted to, when I had Jonathan, we were starting to think about schools. The school in Shildon is not particularly good. So we moved back into a new build in Aycliffe. And also my brother now lives up there and he's a single dad with his own 17-year-old boy.
We were just saying because my eldest is seven, and I was in my very late 30s when I had her. But I'm conscious. But it's really funny when you meet somebody the same age as you, and you just think, hang on a minute. But you do the math, you think, well, actually, yeah, you know, anyone who had children in their mid 20s would now be
have
20-year-olds.
Have friends who are grandparents,
Who are probably younger than you.
Yeah, my age.
Yeah, yeah.
Diana's younger. Yeah, some are younger. It's just been the way it's happened for them.
Yeah. And what about, so you went to university, obviously, at the age of 18. Were you the first in your family to do that? Which is a very common answer in terms of, you know, when I've asked this question. So,
yeah, I mean, my mum and dad, I mean, they were both in the care system at times. But my dad has always been very pro school and education. Although he's struggled. So, for example, he couldn't afford the school uniform because my granddad was a rag and bone man in Bishop. He got into the grammar, as it was then, couldn't afford the uniform, other things happened. So he was kicked out. He didn't fit in with that grammar school, despite having the ability. My mum was a different situation in that she's from a very large family, so my mum is one of 13.
Wow.
So there's 9 full siblings, 3 half sisters and a stepbrother. And her mum died when she was 14, and she was very unhappy. And my granddad, her dad, remarried quite quickly, took the whole family down to Coventry, which from somewhere up here is like right down in the south wherever. And my mum was unhappy, so she left school at 15 and came straight up here to work as a nanny or home help, she called it. She'd look after the children, and so she did that for a long time. So neither of my parents had particularly strong education background, but my dad always felt very keenly that he'd lost his opportunities. So when we were at school, he was very much, you attend every day, you do your best. Yeah. Now that worked great for me. My brother, not so much.
Yeah.
My brother's a very different person. But for me, that was it. I think that's why I was so driven.
Yeah. So they must have been so proud of you when you then went. So how did you end up going to Lampeter?
Oh my goodness. Right. I had a boyfriend at sixth form college who I was very much in love with at the time. And we were going to go to university together. So we were looking at places like Hull and Doncaster, and he was going to do philosophy and I was going to do history. However, we've split up. So all those school universities I'd been considering were like, nah, not going there now. So we had a talk. I remember at sixth form, we must have had like different people coming in for different things. And the person who was there was talking about choices and had said that, you know, if you want to go somewhere and do a really good degree, you might go to Newcastle or whatever. If you want to do a way out degree, such as Victorian studies, then you go to a way out place like Lampeter. And I actually thought, that sounds good. Now, I didn't know whether I wanted to do Victorian studies, and sometimes I kind of wish I had, but I'm not sure with that degree whether that would have been a helpful degree further on, whereas the history degree was. And I think, and I knew I wanted to be a history teacher. So to me, it was just common sense. So I'd looked around other universities, all which were quite rural, actually. And then I went to the New Ends conference, met you.
Right.
Didn't sleep because I didn't have an alarm clock. Yeah. And I remember, and that was also, I decided to get the bus down rather than the train. Yeah. And I actually got there at something like 7:30. And there wasn't a bus to Lampeter. The buses had stopped at 7:00, which I was like, you what?
This was from Aberystwyth.
This was from Abba, yeah. So I then got on a bus to Aberaeron and phoned the Porter's Lodge, who found the only non-drunk student who could drive the van, which was Tufty, who was the barman. And he picked me up and we went, and I didn't know about the lanes and the driving, but basically drove quite quickly in the middle of the road, because there was no one else on the roads, all the way from Aberaeron to Lampeter. And then the next morning, I looked out and it was just phenomenally beautiful.
Yeah.
And then I had lots of conversations the next night, but I had to get up for this bus to Aberystwyth because I couldn't risk. And I can't remember what day it was. And the journey, so that experience, I also, there was a practical, I also really liked the options for the history modules because they were quite modern, which was where I was at. And then the journey back in the daylight just cemented it.
Yeah. Well, it sounds as though because they went an extra mile, you know, for you and picked you up, you probably thought, well, actually, this is a very kindly, the sort of, you know, that they will, like, bespoke in a way.
Yeah,
you know,
they
will make sure that everybody's, they could have just said, oh, get a taxi and pay for it, but they actually went to a lot of effort.
They did,
and there was something about Lambert.
The porters were lovely. Yeah. The porters were you know, if you had an issue, you knew, like, not personal, but I mean, I also, when I got to know the place, I also liked the setup with the welfare.
Yeah.
Just the whole place. I mean, there's a spot you can sit at where the library is and you can just look out over the hills and it's just so beautiful.
I can actually now remember you talking to you, and it was because I was 17 and I remember I went down the bar and it wasn't for me at all because I'd never really, I was too young and I didn't feel, it wasn't my sort of comfort zone. But I knew that there was another place to go, which was the Reef Deck Lounge.
Yes.
And I remember talking to you, and it was the Gulf War, and
there
was a Question Time special.
That's right.
And we were talking about, and it was with you, because Iron Maiden or something had just entered the charts or something like that. And we were watching the Gulf War, having these strange conversations, about half a dozen of us sitting around the TV.
Yes.
And that was you.
That was me.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So,
because I was thinking this was all brilliant, because of course, obviously, from my background, this wasn't something that happened often.
Yeah.
Just that whole idea of sitting around, talking, having like an academic, what I thought was an academic conversation, just that really, and then I ended up not going to sleep, because I had to be up for the bus in the morning, and I did, and this was obviously before mobile phones.
Yes.
And I hadn't even thought of bringing a little alarm clock.
In my case, on the day that I left, because I remember they showed us Taxi Driver.
Well, I didn't see that.
No, and I'm not sure they should have shown it in a way, but it has such an impact on me that I ended up studying it many years later while I was still in Lampeter. I probably was impressionable, but it made a huge impression at that age. And never seen anything like it. Completely blew me away. But then the next morning when we had to leave, I went with a friend from school. And we missed the bus, or we were on the wrong bus. So we had to get a local bus down to Carmarthen, and the train from Carmarthen.
Oh, yeah, because you'd have been...
So down to Cardiff. So a completely different experience. But I knew it was the place for me.
I just knew it. And then the offer was good. Because obviously at the time Lampeter tended to go more for the whole person than their academic output. I got the offer and then did slightly better actually in my A levels. You know, as I was speaking before, I don't even like large schools.
Yeah.
I prefer much smaller, you know, where you can get to know people. I actually found Durham very difficult. So when I changed from Lampeter and I came back up here and I did my PGC year, I was going through some things because Chrisella had died. That she was there and she'd been up here and she actually was killed on her way home from up here.
Oh, wow.
But there was that, but there was more than that. I wasn't happy at the university. It wasn't... I think that comfort that I felt at Lampeter just wasn't there at Durham. And I mean, I was at the School of Education. I wasn't at, like, the bigger university part. It was quite small, but I just... There wasn't that nurturing there that you got. You know, you felt really... I mean, I remember wandering around Lampeter, God knows what time, going on walks.
Yeah. Falkendale Lake, perhaps.
The Falkendale Lake, midnight, just because we felt like it.
Yeah.
And none of us felt... I mean, I can remember them doing that. Oh, we're going to reclaim the night. Well, you didn't need to reclaim the night in Lampeter, to be fair, because, I mean, and I remember the year that I was living... In when I was living at T. Glynn, do you remember?
I do.
Yeah, I mean, I remember someone saying, "Oh, but it's a very long path from the bus stop to the." And they were like, "What if you get a tart?" And I'm going, "Well, he'll kill me because he's got to be really sick if he's standing down this path that very few people go down waiting to attack someone." So I mean, I felt. Very safe at Lampeter. Something I didn't necessarily feel at Durham.
But what about very earliest memories? How far, not necessarily at Lampeter, but I mean, you know, in your life, what can you remember doing and enjoying doing as a child?
My earliest memories. I can remember when we lived on a council estate and they were doing up the houses and we had to move and we literally moved around the corner and I wasn't happy. And I can remember that disruption of having to move, but not being in a place that we were going to be in for long, and my mum fussing, and a boy called Clive who lived nearby. I can remember those and playing very collaboratively with the children in that area. We it was like you had like a field, like a green common bit in the middle, because Aycliffe is a new town in that. You know, it was built after the 1946 Act, deliberately. And as a result, there was loads of green spaces in Aycliffe, which was one of the reasons my mum went there, because she'd grown up in the middle of nowhere, up by Tow Law, literally in the middle of nowhere. We used to go up there for family picnics, and it's literally the countryside with a few ruined houses in it. So my mum's never been one for cities and big towns. And so there was lots of green spaces, and I can remember, you know, having our dolls and the boys having cars and us having dolls and having an army camp. But I think our dolls were quite bossy. Or sitting, I was quite young at this one, there was some bungalows and then a green area which had loads and loads and loads of daisies in them. And I can remember being very little and making daisy chains.
Yeah.
Very contented in the grass, just making these massive daisy chains.
And because when these were the days before social media, we managed to fill the time.
Oh, goodness,
but in a way that, you know, I know that my children, you know, who sort of knew how to use a TV remote control, I think, before they could start walking and talking, you know, that they it's a different sort of...
It was completely different. Makeup. My mum at the time was working at the local... Well, Catholic club we had, which was literally over the road from where we lived. So she was cleaning there. So if she didn't have childcare, she would take us because no one really cared. And it was a club, and there was other children whose mums. And we used to, no health and safety here. We used to go into the attics of this massive Catholic club, which is demolished now. And we used to play in the attics together and explore different parts of it. We were very big on... I was very big on exploring. And, I mean, we later moved because the houses we were living in were demolished. And my mum got the house she's still in, actually, which literally overlooks a park. So my mum's back door, you go out, there's green, few bushes, three football pitches and a play park at the top. So we just, when we were kids, we just used to play out there all of the time and just go exploring. And, you know, there was a stream and there was this tunnel, and we thought it was dead romantic, and we used to, but we didn't dare go through the tunnel, and because there could be rats in there. Well, no, there couldn't. It was a it was a steel tube, just to let it go under a path or something. But we used to go there, and the, as I say, Aycliffe has lots and lots of green areas. It has like a massive walk called the Aycliffe Way, where you can cycle or walk. It's about 12 miles. I have done it with, I did it when we had the dog, and it just goes, and you barely see a house.
And what about things that were going on, like music? I mean, I was somebody completely obsessed as a child with the charts, you know, what the sounds at the time, what was going on musically. Did that sort of impact on you at all?
It did. I mean, I was dancing as well, so, oh yeah, I could have told you about my first ever dancing costume when I was dressed up as I'm a Little Teapot, my first tap dance in a show. Yeah. And my mum's got this photo of me with a big round cardboard teapot cut out, and my black tap shoes. So I used to dance. I used to do the tap, which is actually still a big thing. It's always been a massive thing in Aycliffe. There's always been, for the size of the town, there's always been a lot of different dance skills. And it was just the thing that the children, like, your girls would, and some boys, but not many, but the girls would do dancing. And so from that point of view, the music was important as well. But that, I've got a very eclectic taste, because my mum is very into music. She has to have a music on. And for her, it's all 60s. So there are some very bizarre 60s songs that I know the words of. For like Penny Arcade by Roy Orbison, or excerpt from a teenage opera.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I know all the words to that.
That was
I loved that song.
That was like number 3 in the chart when Radio 1 started in 67. Keith West.
Yeah, but my mum had it on a tape.
Grocer Jack.
Your Grocer Jack. And also, I shouldn't say his name, but Jimmy Savile had his nostalgia music on.
Oh, the old record club.
And my mum used to always have that on making Sunday lunch. And she also liked Boney M.
Yeah.
For some bizarre reason. Yeah. But then my dad would have, I remember he was like, when we had our stereo, he was like in a record club.
Yeah.
You know, on the cassette. And he had like the Joshua Tree and Kate Bush, Hounds of Love.
Yeah.
My first record I ever bought was Mirror Mirror by Dollar.
Yeah, I remember that.
And
one.
Land of Make Believe.
Yeah, I got that one as well.
I loved Book's Fizz.
Yeah.
I didn't see them. We have a little music festival in Shildon, and it's very like it was called Shildonbury. Now they've changed the name, which I think is a real shame, because I really like the idea of having a really naff Glastonbury in Shildon.
Yeah.
And it's actually, but it's a very friendly day out. And so I saw T'Pau there, and Bucks Fizz were on, but it poured down, and it was, and Elizabeth was with us, and she just got so wet that we ended up going home before we saw Bucks Fizz. But I did see Bucks Fizz once by accident. We were on a holiday, and it wasn't the full Bucks Fizz, it was a couple of them. We were in the other room. We were in the family room, the kids were little, so we were watching Rory the Tiger. And Bucks Fizz were on. So I thought, oh, I'll just nip in. I went in and they were singing Bat Out of Hell. And that was it. I was like, gone.
Yeah.
Because no one can sing Bat Out of Hell like me, love.
Yeah.
When I was younger, that was the kind of thing that I was into. When I met Helen in year 7, in first year seniors, she was much more into her music. So that's when I got into it. But some of the contemporary music, so like the Jam, I wasn't bothered about when I was a kid. I kind of, and Meatloaf,
yeah.
I kind of got into it when I was older, before I went to Lampeter. Yeah. So, you know, I remember taping all my albums to go down to Lampeter and having, you know, the Beautiful South, but also lots of mixtapes. I think Andrew did me a lovely mixtape for me to go down, so I could remember him with Leo Sayers, When I Need Love.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so music is important. Now, I listen to lots of absolute 80s.
Yeah.
I really like the Forgotten 80s show on a Sunday night. So I'll go to bed and I'll listen to that. I've now discovered Bluetooth speakers.
Yeah.
we got some for Christmas. I'm like, I didn't have a... Oh, well, isn't that good? And that's usually the way I react to technology. Oh, I don't want them. Yeah, oh, that's quite good, yeah, actually. It's yeah. quite handy. So I listen to them and I listen to some of the podcasts. But I have my own Spotify yeah. mixers and I just have loads on there.
But what I used to do when I was in my room in Burgess Hall in Lampeter and in later years, I used to record stuff off the radio just for myself. I thought, oh, I like that song.
Yeah.
And I'd often keep in the words of the presenter who was just speaking before and after. And I kept all the tapes and I digitised them some years ago. So I play them in the car on a constant loop. So as I'm driving wherever I am, it's sort of like, oh, that was second year undergraduate Lampeter. And I remember that day, that was the day I had that lecture or I met that person or went to play pool or had an exam.
The song that reminds me most of Lampeter is that on our leaving disco,
yeah.
they played Electric Dreams.
By Giorgio Moroder, Phil Oakley.
Yeah. And I can remember crying and dancing yeah. and everyone hugging and I was just in tears.
Yeah.
And every time I hear that, that makes me think of...
Yeah, yeah. And I hear that song actually at the cinema these days.
It's an advert. Yeah, yeah. There's an advert with it at the moment. But I mean, I liked it before,
yeah.
but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that takes me way back to 1984, 85.
Yeah. Hang on. I'm just thinking because it was from the film Electric Dreams.
Yeah.
Which was about very early email type communications, wasn't it? And the two computers spoke to one another and got their owners to fall in love.
Yeah.
I watched some dodgy films in the 80s.
Well, I didn't, you see, that's the problem. I discovered film later. But for me, it was a matter of catching up in later years on those films, which all my contemporaries were watching.
Now, you see, for me, the trip to the cinema was really cheap because... Mm. It was at a time when the cinemas, with the thought that cinema was going to collapse with the advent of VHS and stuff. So the cinemas had all lowered their prices, a bit like they've done now as well, because I know our local view, we dropped the price.
Mm.
So we at the time could go for 50 pence on a Saturday, and the train fare back and forth to Darlington
was more expensive than
was
ticket.
A pound. So I got £3 pocket money, which would leave me with £1.50 for sweets and drink.
Yeah.
So we spent quite a bit going to, like, with my friends, just getting on the train, going to the cinema. So I saw, I remember seeing Rocky IV because someone hit me.
Right.
Literally, I had came out with a black eye.
Well, actually, at the cinema, somebody hit you.
Yeah.
Because they were so carried away in the film?
No, because I wouldn't let them. Because I wouldn't let them have me drink. And I was probably a bit cheeky about it being, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, they wait till the end of the film, and then they hit me.
Yeah.
First one I ever saw on my own without parents was Back to the Future '85.
Yeah.
And we saw it without parents.
Yeah.
I thought I was just the bee's knees. Yeah. But we also had a VHS shop in it. We had two in Aycliffe. So we had the one which was like the blockbuster one or whatever, the posh one, the proper one. And we had a really dodgy one round the back, which didn't really care about too much about who they were let. I mean, I think if it was really bad. So we watched Howard the Duck.
I've never seen it. Is that Tim Robbins? Is Tim Robbins in that?
It is. It's a marvel, actually, because he appears in one of the Guardians of the Galaxy films. There's a duck in it.
Yes,
that's Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
And it's but there's some very sort of dodgy sexual duck things going, and it really wasn't an approach. It was a flop, but it had it's got a cult following. And also The Outsiders, because we'd read the book, The Outsiders. Mm. So that led to my lifelong obsession with Patrick Swayze.
You see, I think this is why I'm doing all this nostalgia work, because I kind of missed out a lot, as I was very aware at the time. You know, you only know you're missing out on something when later on you think, well, actually, the people that I know, the people I trust, the people I like, the things that they talk about, the interest they have, I share with them. But somehow there are these gaps along the way. So for me, it was a matter of going back sometimes and saying, well, if the people that I like and trust and know are recommending this, that and the other, well, let me sort of see what the fuss is about, and then we can have those more complete conversations. So I had this complete, you know, re-immersion in 1980s pop culture. I knew all the music at the time. I was completely obsessed with the charts and music, but the film, that came to me much later.
You see, I had a lot of soundtrack albums. So the Top Gun soundtrack is one of my all-time favourites. Yeah. And the Dirty Dancing one. Yeah. I had Dirty Dancing 1, Dirty Dancing 2. I mean, I'm just... Dirty Dancing is just the film for me.
I was sitting in Greg's in Durham yesterday, and... Is it Eric Carmen came on and Hungry Eyes?
Hungry Eyes.
That's from Delta. Yeah.
You have seen it.
In more recent years.
That's
a few
fine.
Times.
That's
yeah.
fine.
Yeah.
My husband doesn't like it. Yeah. But I love it. Yeah. It's just. I used to write fan fiction before fan fiction even occurred about Dirty Dancing and The Outsiders, and I would combine these to this. I was looking back, I was a very dramatic teenager.
Yeah.
I liked the drama.
Yeah.
And I would write these fan fictions. As I said, that's what you would call it now.
Yeah.
But I would just have these notebooks full of these stories, which kind of mixed up the films. Because I read a lot as well. I'm a massive reader. And a lot of the film choices as well.
Did you keep all of these?
No.
Do you wish you had?
I don't know, because I don't think the writing was particularly good. I kept some... I've got some old diaries that I tried to keep. Oh my God, could I ramble on? These aren't just like ideas about life and stuff. And I'm going to write, I was very much like Adrian Mole. I was not going to write in it every day and then never did.
Yeah.
So yes, but I do have old diaries from the time with some of the ramblings in. But no, I don't have any of those. They were just in, my mum is borders on obsessive with cleaning and chucking out, which is one of the reasons I think I'm so untidy and a hoarder. So anything like that would be just chucked.
Yeah. No, and I found, just going back to what we were saying about Dirty Dancing, I saw it on stage, I think, before
I saw
the film. And of course there was that line, nobody puts baby
in
the
corner.
And of course that was always my joke with my daughter, that if we went to a restaurant and they'd say, okay, if your daughter sits over here, and I never said it, but you almost wanted to say, no one puts baby in the corner.
Yes.
But that's priceless. But it's interesting, isn't it, that those things that we watch at such a young age, formatively, you know, 20, 30 years on. I know people who've done research on, I was never into sort of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but people who were sort of in their early teens at that time, now in their well into their 30s, maybe older, who one of them is doing research on this, and she says that by day she has a normal job, and I think she's living in Finland, I think, and has a normal job and does all the sort of things that one has to do as an adult with children, but by night it's almost like those online forums, and all those people who like her watch this as a 12, 13 year old. And it never left them. There was something that connected at a young age. And even though you then followed the path of conventionality, it doesn't, you know, if you had to define yourself, you wouldn't necessarily define yourself by your job, by your career. But there are certain things that you sort of feel never leave you. You never want to leave you. And there's a whole community of like-minded people.
Mine, because I do get a bit of obsessive. So mine, when I was younger, was the TV programme V. So I've always had a science fiction bent, which was about aliens that were lizards, and had Robert Englund in it. And another bloke who I can't remember his name. And then in the 90s, it was Babylon 5.
Yeah.
Now, I am obsessed. Yeah. I am on fan forums. I am on...
Yeah.
And Terry Pratchett.
Yeah.
Terry Pratchett is just... That's probably more... I mean, I started reading him before I went to Lampeter.
Yeah.
And he seriously... That Discworld, I haven't read his final book because I can't bear for it to end. I just can't. And I'm on a lot of fan forums for that. But it's just... But that's not just about... It's really interesting because the fan pages that I'm on Facebook are not only about his work but also about the way he lived his life.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time they'll say, oh, we need to be more Terry, as in we need to be kinder, we need to be nice. So a lot of the stuff that's posted will be like, you know, this is somebody from America and isn't this lovely the way that they've dealt with a homeless person or an animal. And there's a lot of it's more than just the novels. Mm. It's the lessons that are taught in the novels. Yeah. Yeah. Because some of his lines are just amazing. And Granny Weatherwax, who's one of who's my favourite character, says something like, oh, what was it she says? Something about treating people as things is where it all starts going bad. Yeah. That's not the exact quote, but that's the meaning of it. And from that, as I say, there's this whole kind of... I mean, he was a atheist, very atheist. Yes. But in his novels, although he explores spirituality and churches, he also, he kind of, his philosophy is that you've got to be a good person.
No, and of course that's exactly what my research in later years was very much looking at. That's brilliant. No, absolutely. And because you've got some sort of there are some sociologists sometimes who say, well, people are not going to churches anymore, so therefore it shows that religion's on the way out, and they invoke the secularisation thesis. But then, as you say, you just point to the whole world of Terry Pratchett and Discworld and some of those other cult sort of fandom, works of fiction, of literature, of film, and you say, well, people are exploring those sort of meaning-making systems are there.
Yeah.
They've just been appropriated.
Well, even Babylon 5 is a very spiritual program. I mean, because you've got Jakar, who starts off being a very belligerent person, and by the end of the arc, he is revered as a religious icon. Yeah. And he doesn't understand why, because all he did was write a book, but the book then got copied, and then people found solace and inspiration. So there's a lot of things about spirituality and the universe and that without it being. And I think that's good.
Yeah. And were there particular teachers who inspired you, either, well, I guess both at school and at university? Because obviously, education is massively important to you.
My history teacher, Mr. Deeks, and actually my other history teacher, Mr. Clare. So very different relationships with both men. So Mr. Clare was the head of history and our head of year at school. He is now our county councillor, very active in the... Mm. And he's Labour. So I also know him through, because I've got a bit more involved with Labour. Because a colleague stroke friend of mine is the president of our local CLP, so I've started going to a couple of meetings. But John Clare, who's also renowned for his GCSE history books, for GCSE and Key Stage 3, when the Key Stage 3 framework came online, he was a bit ahead of the game, and he wrote the textbooks. And the amount of skills I've gone in on a supply, and they've had JT Clare textbooks in their back. I mean, it's not as relevant for the curriculum since Gove changed the syllabus, but before it was. And so Mr. Clare, who we once managed to avoid the First World War in our history lesson, because he was very hands-on. Mm. But Mr. Deeks as well. Now, he was a very religious person. He was, he left education to go into, to be, I don't think it was a vicar, it was more of an evangelical pastoral, but he actually left education to go into that area. So those two at school. I remember Malcolm, do you know what, it's really horrible, right, because I don't remember that many of my lecturers or their names. I think university, I can remember the names of people, I can remember what we've done, I can remember some of the lectures, but I can't remember names. But I'm not brilliant with names now.
But Malcolm Smith, you're going to mention,
Yeah, Malcolm Smith. I remember him because he's the one who also kind of... I ended up on a disciplinary board at Lampeter, which was incredibly difficult, and taught me I'm not going into law. He ran this... I was involved with the History Society, and so was he. And also when we went to that lovely place...
Gwickinog?
Yes. Yeah. When we went to Gwickinog, and I went twice, and he did his history and film, because of course...
Yeah.
Yeah, I did that as well.
I wish I had, actually. Because I knew Mark, in really later years, I had a few conversations with him.
It was really interesting. I mean, I remember watching Zulu and falling asleep. And Doctor Strangelove, and how I learned to love the bomb.
Yeah.
And that's been, and that's a film I would never have even attempted to watch. And I love it now. And I could, you know, with the irony and all that, Peter Sellers. And I also remember doing an essay on looking at post-war culture and looking at the effect of the atomic bomb on post-war culture, as in 1945 onwards, and doing an essay on apocalyptic, because I'm also quite... I'm a keen reader of apocalyptic and dystopian novels as well. And bringing Judge Dredd comic into this, and every time I kept writing, you know, it's the end of the world, thinking of that REM song as I know it, and I feel absolutely. Fine. So Malcolm, I remember, and there was a lady who I did my dissertation with. She did a course on women's history, and I did my diss, and that was on women's education. You see, I knew that I was going to teach, and it was on women's education from 1870 to 1980.
Wow. So everything's come full circle for you, really. Mm. So it's, and I think, and that's one of the great things at university, because sometimes with my own students, they don't realise the skills that they're picking up in some cases, just by giving a talk, a 5-minute presentation with another student. That, you know, if they're ever doing a job interview in the future, or they have to give a presentation on a topic, and, you know, and in a way that they've got maybe somebody like me taking notes, and they've got other students who might ask questions afterwards, it might be difficult to go through, it might be a challenging experience, but afterwards they'll say, actually, now that I've done that, you know, and survived it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, schools try and bring those skills further down. So, for example, as I said, the school that my friend goes to, her son goes to, Max, he goes to UTC, which is a very different approach. It's a more university approach. So he has to give presentations. Yeah. And they do all sorts. They go into primary schools and do science with, like, so they get 10 students going to a primary school to do scientific experiments that the teachers aren't necessarily going to do. I mean, obviously, there's supervision. But he has to give presentations, and my friend Claire says, you know, and we try, you know, with the best will in the world, you try to do that in mainstream, but it's not always as easy when you've got a class of 30 and you're having to be out of the classroom with one student doing their presentation or keeping the class quiet while they sit through 30 very, very, very similar presentations because just the nature of their ages. So they do try and get it in, but as I say, in mainstream it is very hard.
Yeah. And it's interesting as well, because you were talking about obviously the political element of your interest, your research, your dissertation. My sense of being at Lampeter in that particular era is that although there were two, well, in my undergraduate days, there was the 92 general election, and I was still there for 97. But people didn't really tend to be super, the students didn't tend to be motivated.
It's the only time I haven't voted Labour.
Yeah.
I've voted Plaid Cymru in the 92
election. So you actually voted in Lampeter? Because I voted in Cardiff.
No,
but
because I knew, I was fairly politically minded, and I knew that Sedgefield, which is a constituency, well, actually we were in Bishop Auckland then, but the constituency that I was in was Secure Labour.
Of course, Tony Blair was the MP.
Well, yes, that was in the 97, the 97 one, because, it, as I say, they changed the boundaries. And I remember going to the meeting and listening to the Plaid Cymru candidate and feeling that he was the best person. Yeah. And I felt my vote would count more in Lampeter than it would have in Aycliffe. Yeah. So I actually voted Plaid Cymru, only time I haven't voted Labour.
Yeah.
And I fought all the time because women died for the right to vote.
Absolutely, And that's why I will sometimes talk to my students. And I'm going back a few years now and, you know, I got the sense that, you know, I was once giving an example of, you know, did anybody see Newsnight last night? And they all said no.
I don't watch Newsnight or Question Time because I yell at the telly. So I've stopped watching it. Yeah. I get so annoyed when certain political parties are on and I just want to scream at the telly, and it's just easier not to. I am quite selective in politically in what I access because, I mean, I'll tell you now, I'm a Corbynist.
Yeah.
I've seen him speak two or three times now at the big meeting. I've also met John McConnell. I've also met Angela Rayner.
Yeah. Her backstory is so amazing. I think when she gave her maiden speech at the Commons, and she said, you know, she effectively her teachers wrote her off because
she had
a child very young, and she left, I think, without GCSEs.
Yes, she did.
And didn't she say, she said, well, there we are.
Look at me now.
Yeah.
Well, it's really funny because a colleague of mine comes from Seaham, which is on the coast, but it's quite a deprived area because it was the coal mining area. So her father was a painter and decorator, but in that area. So when the 84-85 strike was on, they didn't have any money coming in, or very little money coming in, because although he wasn't down the pits, his money kind of depended on the men who were. So, and she was, she's the first to admit she was a sod at school, left school young, had a child, worked in a various factory jobs, and she's now teaching English at another deprived area over in South Shields. Fortunately, they're closing their schools because they failed an Ofsted, and no academy wants to pick them up, so they've closed the school, which is a shame because from a community point of view, the school's really important. But of course, nowadays, that community element isn't high on the what they want to do.
Yeah. I hear a lot of people sometimes say, oh, well, you know, Corbyn isn't electable because he doesn't inhabit the middle ground. And I say, well, hang on a minute. In Canterbury, we have our first Labour MP ever in the constituency's history. And I saw the students all out in droves to vote at the polling station on campus. I didn't even know there was a polling station on campus, but this election, I saw it in The Guardian, and they said, there were pictures saying, look at all these students at the University of Kent campus, and I thought, I need to go and check this out for myself. So I just, it's only 2 minutes away from my office, and I could see them all there, and I'm guessing in most cases perhaps voting Labour. But I have to say, you know, when people say that about Corbyn, what they underestimate is the fact that he gets people out and excited about politics.
So a couple of years back at the big meeting, not last big meeting, the big meeting before. So I'll just, so the big meeting is the Durham Miners Gala, but locally it's referred to, I've always referred to it as a big meeting, quite an important part of my life growing up, because we'd meet up with all the extended family who lived scattered around Durham, or my aunties from Coventry would come up for the big meeting and we'd all go out as a family. So, but recently I'm going with the union, so I am, I'm actually marching. So last year, although I was with the NASUWT, I marched with the Women's Banner Group, which you should look up if you want nostalgia. And if you ever want to interview anyone from that, I know the lady who is in charge. So,
brilliant.
You know, if you ever, if you up again, let me know, and I'll arrange for you to contact Laura. And she'll be over the moon. So I walked with the women's, I was the NAS rep with the Women's Banner Group. But the year before, I'd gone and Corbyn was speaking, and the showground was, it's massive. And someone actually got on stage and started wanting to talk to Jeremy Corbyn. Literally, it was like this with it, touching him. And he didn't kind of say, oh, get her off. He's going, and she, we couldn't hear what she was saying. And he's saying, I'll speak to you in a minute, love. I'll speak to you soon. And the way he handled her was not that of a politician. It was of a person who was like, it was almost like, I'm in this situation. What I really want to do is that, but obviously I'm the leader. And then we were walking back into Durham along the sands, and we saw him, and he was mobbed. He had to have a police protection around him. And it was a nightmare for the police because he was wanting to shake everyone's hand who wanted to shake his. And the police were trying to move him on. And people were just mobbing him. And I'm not on about just the students. I'm on about people of all ages. The people were really like just wanting to speak to him. And I know a lot of people go on about the cult of personality and all that. But I think that's almost, if you see him, that's where that comes from. You just want to know him. He's just like, you know, a geography teacher. I know a lot of people.
And he's been likened to that, hasn't he?
But then people are using that as a slur. Oh, he's like a geography teacher. Well, actually, Some brilliant teachers.
And I think what happened in his case is that because he didn't follow the same path, you know, if he'd ever wanted to become leader of his party, he wouldn't have been a serial rebel. He would have tried to be a minister or shadow minister. He would have tried to accommodate the party's previous leadership, you know, inner circles. He didn't do any of those things. And so his election was a time when people were quite disillusioned with politics. And suddenly here is somebody who speaks their language and who you feel is a politician of genuine principle and conviction. And I think that frightened a lot of the people who kind of thought, well, actually, hang on a minute, this is, you know, he doesn't fit the mould.
The problem I worry about the North East is the rise of the far right and UKIP. And because we've got some incredibly deprived areas. Now, those deprived areas come as a result of Thatcher. And although in the 84-85 strike, I kind of wish I'd been much more alert, but I was like 10.
Yeah.
So to me, but I remember, I mean, my uncles were on the picket lines. And I remember kind of the whole era. And now the children or grandchildren of those miners are still in a really bad area. You know, it's gone downhill. Yeah. They want to, so they go for this UKIP anti-Brexit because that kind of allows them to blame others.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's not our fault. It's not it's not Britain's fault that, you know, we're governed from London and they really don't care about the North East because of lots of different reasons. It's not the government's fault that our large industries have failed. It's easier to do the whole, you know, and I know Sunderland is a hotbed for UKIP.
And it's kind of ironic because in areas like London where there's much more immigration, there's much more of an ethnic mixture, UKIP don't do so well. But in places like the North East, where you don't have that same ethnic mixture, they tend to do quite well. And they're talking about immigration, but it doesn't seem to be an issue that affects the region in the same way that it might do London and the South.
And but it's this, it's this idea of the other, the other person. Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It's the image, it's the belief that this other is getting more money, better benefits, better housing, better this, better that, than they are. So they can then blame it. And it doesn't matter whether they're Muslim, it doesn't matter whether they're from Romania, it doesn't matter, or Jew, or whatever it is. I mean, it's the same thing that that's what worked in Germany, in between the wars, this other that they can blame their problems on. And we have got an issue with that. And I've taught in schools where I've deliberately avoided certain subjects because I don't want the kids to, you know, come out with this rant.
Some more philosophically based questions. would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones as you survey your whole life?
Yes. Yeah. My memories are more positive than my life sometimes. Yeah. Of course, everyone's got bad memories. But for me, my child, my growing up was great. Very green areas, a lot of freedom. I loved the school I went to. At the time, the sixth form I went to was much smaller than it is now. But I enjoyed going there and I had lots of friends. I'm still very close to a lot of people I went to school with.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why I settled back in the area. You know, I could have gone anywhere, but I did have my husband to come back, like boyfriend.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I was always very active as well. So I did my dancing three times a week. I would also do school productions and, you know, I was out there and I really enjoyed my childhood.
Yeah.
I remember being moody when I was a teenager and dramatic, as I've said before. I didn't have masses of friends. I wasn't somebody who just like, but I had like one very, I was bullied in year, in the first year, but out of that became a lifelong friendship because.
Oh, with the bully?
No. What happened was Helen, my best friend, had been off and this bullying had started and it was girls that I thought were friends.
Yeah.
And she came and they like got a hold of her and kind of says, oh, we're doing this to Donna. Are you going to join in? And she went, no. And she stood up for me.
Wow.
And that's and we became, and we're still friends now.
Yeah. See, I often think about this because I had some similar experiences. I mean, anybody who's perceived to be in any way different, which means they're not going to play by the same game, they're not going to, you know, anybody at school who seemed to be a little bit idiosyncratic, a little bit not going to play by the same game, the same rules as anybody else, is then tortured for it. And I wonder, you know, to this day, I often think about some of those people and the nastiness. And you think that there probably was maybe some abuse. They were they neglected home.
Not always.
Not in all cases. They just sort of, they like to assert their superiority over other people for whatever reason. But I do wonder to this day whether all these years on, do they ever look back and do they think, oh, or do, you know, maybe they haven't changed. I'm always interested in that because the victims of school bullying often, you know, the scars are with you forever. But I often wonder whether the bullies themselves ever reach a point just on their own, where they, or maybe they have children of their own and they think, oh, I wouldn't really want my child to go through what I put somebody else through.
I don't know. I think sometimes it's selective memory, isn't it? And I mean, for me, in my first year, so I had a group of friends who, looking back, weren't necessarily good friends. And I wasn't in the same class. I was in a higher class than they were. So that was resentment. I had a bad lisp at the time, which, well, I still have if I don't control it. I remember my nose being an issue, but I was quite small and intelligent and keen to do well, and that doesn't always fit. And they just, I don't know why. I really don't know why. I mean, I never learned till years later that my mum had gone up to the school. And mum never told me, and the school never told me. And then it stopped. Now, I put all that down to Helen. But it, I think it was a combination of things. I think, you know, once I was friends with Helen, Helen isn't someone you would have messed with. So she kind of became like a bit of protect. But then I didn't care about the other girls. Because I was with, I was friendly with Helen. And Helen, I then started to, my range of friends changed a lot because Helen had, like me, you know, she had a lot of lame ducks, if you want. You know, so the boys that we hung out with were usually from the lower ability classes. And we got to, you know, Stuart, a friend of mine who I've known since primary school. You know, he's still a really good friend. So my friendship values changed. I didn't want, you know, I wasn't as dependent on this group of girls. I was more, I was like, well, you don't really matter anymore.
And you're still very much in touch with some of these friends then?
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We actually had a school reunion a couple of years back. Mike, one of these friends, organised it, bless him, 25 years. And it was actually quite interesting to kind of see and witness, you know, these girls who had been the top dogs, as it were, suddenly sort of reclaiming that. It's quite,
No, it took me many years to feel comfortable. I never had a school reunion, but I went to my first Lampeter reunion only last year, but there weren't that many from our era.
That's something that's always stopped me before. So
mainly a lot of 60s and 70s graduates.
Yeah, but now I think more are coming. And I know if you're going to be there and maybe David and somebody else, then that's why I'd like to go, not this year, but maybe next year.
Yeah, but it took me a while to feel comfortable in my own skin, but also to sort of feel that I knew what my narrative was, in the sense that I stayed in education. I was still in Lampeter for many years.
Yes.
I was aware that there were lots of reunions taking place around me, and some people were saying, oh, so what are you doing these days? You said, no, I'm still here. So because I felt I needed to go away, achieve what I needed to do, and then sort of say, you know, now I know where I am and I've got sufficient distance and the ability to reflect on that, rather than to feel, well, actually it's almost as though I'm too, I haven't quite moved on from those roots.
Yeah.
I haven't gone away and come back, let's put it that way.
I mean, a lot of my contemporary, it's actually quite funny because a lot of my contemporaries, the women have done better than the men.
Yeah.
So the women are nurses, the women are professionals in some way or other. I mean, Helen was a journalist. And the men, just a lot of them haven't kind of got out of that. Some have, obviously, but more of the women are, you know what I mean, like that professional, which is quite an interesting one. But then the northeast is quite matriarchal anyway.
Interesting, yeah.
Although they'd like you to think it's patriarchal, yeah. It's not. It's the mums, the aunts, and the grands.
Yeah.
You know, I remember being at our family do's. I mean, with such a massive family, so we had because my granddad had moved the family down to Nuneaton and Bedworth, so the sort of that Midlands area. When they used to come up for holidays, because my holidays used to be down there, but when we used to come up, they used to come up, we used to have big gatherings, and so big we could never have them in the house, we'd always have a tent somewhere with them. And you know, it was, I remember being so proud to be allowed to sit with the mums and the aunts and butter the bread and sitting very quietly listening to all this family history. I mean, mum is a font of family history. And she knows everyone's birthdays and whose child is whose, and, you know, because it does get complicated.
And I guess you probably notice these things more having gone away. And when you come back, because I used to find that, I would see my hometown, it was familiar, but also a little bit strange in some ways. Having been away, you just have a little bit more sort of critical distance, I suppose.
Yeah. But again, it was that whole... That was part of my childhood. Yeah. That was a very comforting and safe place, which is probably why I did so well in Lampeter.
Yeah.
Because I came from, yes, it was a massive family. Yes, we lived, you know, we lived slightly away from other relatives. You know, a lot of my relatives were on the East Durham coast because they worked within mining. So, like, my uncles all lived over there. But when we would get together, it was a very safe... And also social. I mean, socially, I think maybe that's why in at school, I was better with just one or two. Because of course, coming from a family that big, we've got a range of socio-economic. You know, so I've got my cousins who still live in Easington, who I don't have on Facebook because I don't want to see their posts.
Yeah.
And I'll have arguments with them, and they were always the same. And they thought just because they were a bloke, they were better. And I was quite different in my family as well because I knew I was more intelligent than them, which was a problem sometimes. But you know, that's just who I was, and they accepted me, and I held my own in my family.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you have achieved or fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young. I mean, it sounds as though, you know, there was that question of regret, isn't there? I mean, I you know, do you ever wish you'd done things differently? Are you...
I wish I'd travelled a bit more, but I'm not the best of travellers, which I've found out. So, for instance, at the end of my degree, me and Helen were supposed to go travelling in France, which I did. She didn't because she had a fever and she never joined us, and I ended up with a friend of hers who I'd only met twice. And it was a horrible experience. But it wasn't a horrible experience. It was an experience, I think. I don't like to say anything's horrible or whatever. It was a learning experience. Yeah. And I learned that I didn't really like her very much. And I wasn't really comfortable travelling with someone else. Now, when I've gone to places on my own, and I know that could just mean, like, London. So if I've gone down to London for an examiner's meeting and I'm on my own, I am much happier than if I have the family. I stress a lot. I mean, I'm going to Belfast tomorrow. Yeah. I'm not stressed about the flying, the airport. Oh my God. I've got my money there, my passport. I've already started all that. I'm an absolute nightmare to fly with because I stress in airport.
Yeah.
But there's going to be other friends there. We're travelling. There's quite a few of us on that flight. So it should be all... I've warned them.
Yeah.
So I should be all right.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
No, I find when I'm travelling on my own, I find myself quite resourceful.
Yeah.
When I'm with my family, I sometimes... I'm just... Because they're very young children. I was at Pizza Hut the other night here in Durham on my own. And it was blissful because I went to the salad bar. I helped myself with the children. Everything would be on the floor. They'd break the bowls. They'd be going back and forth to get the bread rolls. They'd be... You know, wanted to go to the ice cream machine, even if we hadn't got to the dessert stage.
Yeah.
And I would just be like apologising all the time or chasing them around the restaurant. So I just thought, I'm actually rather enjoying this.
To be honest, I mean, my two have never been a problem in, you know, but we've gone so rarely, they've always been warned, you know. And But yeah, no, I just, it's London. Yeah. When I'm on my own, if I've got Andrew with us and Elizabeth, it's like, so we went last year, she was in a gymnastics display in Essex, and they all decided to have, they wanted to go into London, but we had like a really tight schedule. So we only had like an hour
yeah.
in London. So the bus driver was great, and he parked off just near Regent Street, not far from Piccadilly Circus. And I'm like, but we've only got an hour. What can we do? And the only thing they could do was go shopping. Yeah. And then I'm like, but it's a complete waste of time just to go into Primark in London yeah. when you've been in Primark in Newcastle. They are the same. Yeah. They have the same clothes.
Yeah.
Mind you, Elizabeth is very excited about the Primark in Birmingham, which is over five floors. And we've got to go into Primark in Belfast yeah. as well. So I'm just like, so for me, like the last couple of times I stayed in Bloomsbury yeah. and I wandered around looking at blue plaques.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Because you can. Yeah.
Because I could. And I saw the bookshop, I got very excited. Which I could, because I was on my own and no one was watching. When I saw the bookshop from the film Pride. Have you seen that one?
I don't think I have, no.
You've got to watch it. Yeah. It's about the gays and lesbians in London. Yeah. They're like a group called.
Yeah.
And they support the miners.
Yeah.
It's in North Yorkshire, yeah. but it's the same kind during the strike. And they raised a lot of money, but a lot of... They kind of approached different villages to say, well, you know, and a lot of them turned them down. And then it's the coming of together, the two union of the two disparate groups, both on kind of the edge, outsides of Thatcher.
Yeah.
But they come together, but it's all brilliant.
Brilliant. No, I will look that out. I've got one more question for you.
Right.
Are you a looking back or a looking forward
looking type back. Of person? I look back a lot.
Yeah.
But I think that's my history as well. Because I've always loved that. And like that, I don't know. When I talk to somebody about history, and I get so passionate, I still get really passionate. Because the boy I work with, I go, I love history. He goes, oh. You know, because... so. And then I've got to be... I'll tell you something, I found it really hard when I first started teaching history. Because I had to go so far down the levels. So I'd been reveling in this wonderful academic history, and then I had to teach it at Key Stage 3, and it is completely different, the way you have to teach it. And I find it hard, because you have to get, like, a whole... So, like, you do the Battle of Hastings in two lessons.
Yeah.
Then you do the Magna Carta in one lesson.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. But, yeah, I do look back a lot. I don't think I regret. I find it hard to look into the future, because I get worried, and I don't want to get worried. And since, and to be fair, I thought that I would be at Tudor Grange, the school that closed and merged, for a lot longer, like further. I had no intention of leaving there. And then that closed, and then I had a lot of issues with the dealing with the change, which is something me and my kids don't do very well. Mm-hmm. And so the result was then I was into this sort of supply, and I didn't, and, you know, I got a contract for 6 weeks at a school, and it was over after a week and a half because the person I was covering was coming back. So I've learned not to look too far in the future. I try to look maybe 6 months or so, or try and take every day as it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for my mental health, that's better, because if I'm looking further into the future, I start to worry.
Yeah.
I can't really look that far into the future. And I don't think I want to. I think I do want to just take things as they come and enjoy. I mean, I would never have dreamt that I would have taught in an FE college, that I would have taught profoundly disabled children. I mean, that was so way out of my comfort zone, because it was so tactile way of working with the children. And so even though there was 15, 16 year olds, it was still so really different. And I wouldn't have dreamt I would have had those experiences, or ended up working for the virtual school, which is the organisation I've been working for, in the way that I have when I left Whitworth when I left mainstream. So that's been nice. I've enjoyed that kind of new experiences, and I was very much entrenched in my job. So by going out and having that these new experiences, I think it's done better for my mental health and for my family life and everything, really. So yeah, I do look back.
But in a very optimistic and almost sort of strangely forward-looking sense. It sounds as though you're looking back, but it sounds as though you're doing it in a way that seems very sensible, very wholesome, very integrated. It sounds like you've sort of got it. You sort of found the formula, I think.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I really wouldn't say that. Not when I'm having a bad day. I'm having a good day today.
Oh, well.
I'm having a really good day today. I am actually in a much better place. I know that really sounds like, you know, I'm in a really good place at the moment. Feel a lot safer now that I've got this full-time and financially safer because I've been on a 0 hours contract situation. Now I've got this safety, so I am looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to going to Belfast tomorrow.
Well, I have to say it has been amazing. 25 years on, and it feels like we've just picked up
that's the conversations. What do you know, what that's what it's like for good friends. Honestly, that's what I say about Helen. I mean, I cannot see Helen. We will literally pick up. You would think we saw each other yesterday when we pick up.
Donna, it has been so amazing. Thank you so much.